Radio.ie hosts the Irish History Show podcast because history matters. Radio turns 100 years young this year. Radio's history is powered by Radio Archives. For radio archiving solutions from people passionate about radio, visit radio.ie.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show. My name is Cathal Brennan, and as always, I'm joined by my co-presenter, John Dorney, from the Irish Story website. If you get a chance, please check out our friends at radio.ie for all your radio archiving solutions. John has set up a Patreon for The Irish Story and The Irish History Show, so if you enjoy reading the articles on The Irish Story or our podcasts here on The Irish History Show, please consider supporting us on the Patreon, and we really do appreciate it. There is a link in the show notes. You can find this episode and all previous episodes of the show on irishhistoryshow.ie. The podcast is available on all the podcast apps like iTunes, Spotify and Stitcher. And if you could take a moment to rate and review the show, we would really appreciate it. You can follow us on Twitter at Irish History Pod or on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. Please let us know what you think of the episodes, as we really love to get your feedback. On this episode, we're going to be discussing a very controversial and very interesting episode in Irish history, the Plantation of Ulster, and one that had a massive effect on Irish history. Wouldn't you say, John?
Yup, I sure would.
Probably the most long-lasting effect up to the present day.
Well, certainly it's had a lot of ramifications. Like, there's, you know, history moves in unpredictable ways, so other things happened which affect in less obvious ways, perhaps. But certainly, in terms of the two states in Ireland today, the Ulster Plantation has had a big effect on that.
Well, one of the things that people sometimes assume is that the Ulster Plantation was the only plantation in Ireland.
No, of course not. So, as we covered in a previous episode about the Desmond Rebellion and another one about the 9 Years' War, plantations or colonisation settlement in Ireland had been going on since the 1540s. So there was plantation in Laois an Offaly, there was large-scale plantation attempted in Munster in the south of Ireland, there were a lot of very small ones. But the Ulster Plantation is a big watershed because, first of all, it was the most rebellious province from the English point of view, or the most warlike province, and it was the least economically developed province. Now, the long-term fallout from the Ulster Plantation would change all of those things.
Yes, and in our last episode on the 9 Years' War, we finished up with the Treaty of Mellifont, which brings an end to the war. And some on the royalist crown side felt it was too generous to O'Neill and the rebels. How do we go from the Treaty of Mellifont up to the start of the plantation?
Okay, so for people who missed our last episode, the Treaty of Mellifont comes in 1603 at the end of the 9 Years' War. So from its name, you can tell it was a long and costly war. The English, and they're still English at this point, the term British is something we're going to encounter now, need to bring it to an end. It's very costly. They also have wars in the Spanish Netherlands. They have an ongoing confrontation in Spain across the Atlantic, of which Ireland is a part. They have to bring it to an end. Hugh O'Neill, the Earl of Tyrone, is still holding out in the middle of Ulster. So the commander in Ireland, Mountjoy, offers him very generous terms. And the terms are that O'Neill can basically have everything that he had before the war, in terms of he can have all his land, he can have also authority over all the other landowners and what are essentially clan leaders in Ulster, his urdaithe, his sub-kings. And the only thing that he has to do is swear renew loyalty to the Queen of England, who's just about to die, Queen Elizabeth. And he has to renounce the title of O'Neill, his clan title, if you like. The only title he's going to have is the Earl of Tyrone. So he has his land, you know, by grant of the Crown of England. That's the only thing he has to do. So it's a massive climb down. And Mountjoy, who is the commander, Blount is his name, is, if you like, the peace party. He wants to do the deal in Ireland and get the heck out. But his military commanders in Ireland, and you have to imagine these are also sort of adventurers, like there's no such thing as full-time professional military at the time.
Yeah.
They have a lot more skin in the game. They intend to build their future in Ireland. Now, in the case of the two most prominent, Chichester, Arthur Chichester, and Davies, James Davies, who was the Attorney General, they had both come to Ireland to avoid prosecution for crime in England. So, you know, they're also younger sons. They don't have a future in England. So what they want is they want the rebels, as they see them, land confiscated. They want them punished. And they also say, you know, they justify their position ideologically. They say, what did we fight for? You know, what did all these men from England and Wales and Ireland die for? Was to crush, you know, the incivility of the Gaelic order and supplant it with a superior, civilised English order. So it's to help the Irish as well, they say. Of course, they want the land. Yeah. It's the thing. But they're really unhappy. And the thing is, Mountjoy, the conciliator, leaves. And the new Lord Deputy is Chichester, you know, the Archhawk, who is, you know, the head of the faction of military commanders in Ireland who want a punitive settlement, who want O'Neill and the arch traitors, as they call them. They want their land taken off them. At quite an early stage, they want them replaced with settlers. Now, there's different views. Davies, the Attorney General, is actually a lot more hawkish on this, it turns out, than Chichester. So Chichester considers that, okay, we'll establish military dominance and people like me will be rewarded with land. Chichester ends up getting Dungannon, which was basically O'Neill's capital, if he had one. But we'll come to that. But most of the land will actually be held by the Irish, whereas Davies wants a much more radical plan where the Irish will be completely supplanted by settlers from England and now from Scotland, because the new king, Elizabeth, dies in 1603, and the new king, James I of England, is also James VI of Scotland.
O'Neill now, after the Treaty of Mellifont, what happens to O'Neill?
So there's quite a complicated picture. I mean, O'Neill surrenders, as we've said, on very good terms. Okay, he doesn't have the military power that he had. He has to disband his army. His army, basically, it shriveled anyway to his, you know, his core following. But he gets almost everything else. Why not just sit it out then? Well, the main reason is the hostility of the people who were running the Kingdom of Ireland. So remember, at the time, Ireland is a kingdom. So it has the same king as England and now Scotland, but it is a separate administration. And that's run by the, you know, by the English administration in Dublin Castle. But they're extremely hostile to Hugh O'Neill. They try to undermine him in various ways. So the first way is Davies tries to go back to what the Tudor monarchs have been trying to do in Ireland throughout the 16th century, which is to break up the Irish lordships. And Davies says the way to do this is to get O'Neill's Uirithe sublords detached from him. And he concentrates on O'Cahan, which is O'Neill's main sublord. I mean, he was his standard bearer. To detach from O'Neill. His argument is O'Cahan has his land from royal patent the same way O'Neill does, so O'Cahan shouldn't pay rents to O'Neill, he shouldn't be under him in any way. And this goes all the way to the court in London. And eventually, interestingly, James I decides in favour of O'Neill. So Davies gets frustrated there. But they have another go, Chichester and O'Cahan do. And this is by implicating O'Neill in a plot for a new Irish and Catholic uprising. And interestingly, the plot is supposedly centred on the Old English, on the Pales people. So, descendants of medieval English colonists.
People who had sort of sat out the 9 Year War.
Sat out the 9 Year War. A lot of them actually did fight in the 9 Year War on the English side. And very few fought on O'Neill's side. Like the Hovingtons, the family he was fostered to. But the allegations come from the St. Lawrence family, who were the Lords of Howth. So if you know Howth Castle in Dublin, I believe the family is still there, actually. Yeah. One of the very few Old English families to come all the way through. But in any case, the allegation is there going to be a new Catholic rising with the aid of the Spanish. This is in 1607. Now, the previous year, Guy Fawkes, a Catholic, had attempted to blow up the Houses of Parliament in England. And there is some allegations O'Neill knew something about that. And it's quite possible that he did, because O'Neill is, in truth, in contact with the King of Spain, Philip II, throughout this time, because O'Neill really does want another go, actually, at the English. O'Neill is implicated in this Catholic plot in 1607 in Ireland. He's summoned to London, and O'Neill assumes, not without reason, that he will be either confined to the Tower of London or he will be assassinated, because this is what's happened previously to Irish lords, and not only to Irish lords, actually, in Tudor politics. At this time, Other Ulster Lords, Maguire and O'Donnell, are preparing to go to Spain, and it appears that O'Neill makes the snap decision that instead of going to London, he's going to go to Spain. And this is the flight of the Earl. So O'Neill makes a hasty flight to Donegal, to Lochswilly, with his retainers and his family, and quite a lot of people, actually, several hundred people, and they embark for Spain. And the idea is to go to Spain, and they'll come back with the Spanish army, and they'll have another go. They'll do the 9 Years' War again, but this time they'll win. Of course, it doesn't happen. They end up permanently in exile. But what's been described as destruction by peace, the administration in Dublin basically ate away at Hugh O'Neill until he felt the only option was to flee the country.
And this clears the way for their next plan.
Yes, it clears the way for the civilising and the plantation of Ulster.
Now, before we get into the crown colonisation of Ulster, and we should talk about the private plantations in Antrim and Down.
Yeah, and just, it's not only there. So one of the effects of the 9 Years' War is there is military forts which are planted throughout Ulster to try to keep the peace, as the English thought, or to keep it in quiescence, whichever you prefer. And there is a certain amount of settlement, like the city of Derry is actually grows from a military settlement. Well, it grows from a monastic settlement, but the English presence comes from a military fort by Henry Dowker during the 9 Years' War. It's actually destroyed in the rebellion of Cathal Doherty, which we'll talk about, but there's a certain amount of settlement there already around Dungannon, Charlemont, various other places. But in the east of Ulster, in Antrim and Down, or South Antrim and North Down, really, is what we're talking about, the Ards Peninsula and stuff, those lands have been quite depopulated. They've been fought over a lot over the previous century. So not only in the 9 Years' War, but prior to that as well. And it's quite close to Scotland. So there had been traditionally an influx of Scots back and forward, mostly Gaelic Scots. But in the aftermath of the 9 Years' War, two men who were both Scottish landowners and also had served in military capacity in Ireland and also in campaigns in the west of Scotland, Montgomery and Hamilton, they ended up acquiring much of the land there. And they did this by various means. The indebtedness of the Irish lords there, the O'Neills of the Fews and the O'Neills, the Clan de Boy O'Neills, Clan Abui, Yellow Hugh, hence the name, the Clan de Boy area. There's also, you know, there's some incredibly complicated kind of artful dodging. So at one point, Hamilton or Montgomery, I forget which one, gets an O'Neill out of jail. He's in trouble with the English and he helps him to escape from jail in return for getting all his land. But for various means, they acquire the land and they settle it very heavily with people from Scotland. Now, one of the things, surprising things that I found when researching this episode was Scotland at the time had a population of about 1.2 million and people considered it massively overpopulated, you know, which I suppose shows how few people a pre-industrial society can support. But Scots were already great migrants, but the main destination in the 16th and early 17th century was Eastern Europe, was Poland and Scandinavia.
I had never heard that before.
But that's a fact. Yeah. Initially, they'd go there military service, but then they'd be settled there on, you know, underpopulated land. But anyway, so Scots are mad to get out of Scotland, apparently, so it seems. Yeah. And a lot of them come to Antrim and Down, and they're settled there. And there's another twist to that story, which is the Gaelic lord of North Antrim, Randall MacDonald, whose ancestors were, well, actually, they were Norse Gaelic by ancestry, but they had come to Ireland in the 16th century, and they had fought with O'Neill in the 9 Years' War, but MacDonald managed to change sides in time, in true Gaelic fashion. For all that he's a Gael and a Catholic, he actually finds it very profitable to bring over lowland Protestant Scottish settlers as well in the north of Antrim. So there's a very heavy settlement because, of course, the east coast of Ulster is facing Scotland. It's very close. But Scots are apparently very keen to move out of Scotland to get their own piece of land, be it in Ulster or anywhere else.
And they make a success with it in Antrim and Down.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing is, though, I mean, we always say this is a private plantation, but it's not possible without state power either. So it's not possible if the place is not garrisoned and conquered first, you know, which is something that comes across very clearly when you're looking at it. Like, okay, the state didn't pay for people to come over or subsidise it, but it did everything else, you know.
And that's really the only part of Ulster throughout, like, Norman Ireland that has, like, a Norman crown presence, a place like Carrickfergus and Newry.
Yeah, and that ties into like some of the medieval titles that the de Courcy family, the Earls of Ulster, in the medieval period had. It ties into some of the means by which they get that land, which is something that happens in the rest of Ireland as well. Like, one of the things that happens in the early 1600s in Ireland is, the argument is, the Gaelic lord has his title only by surrender and regrant, but there might be a previous medieval title given to an Englishman, which might precede it, and a lot of them lose land like this, or they have to lose a third of their land in order to be re-granted it again. So that's consistent with what's happening in the rest of Ireland as well. Yeah, the largest number of Scots certainly settles in Antrim and Down.
So now, before we move on to the plantation proper, we should talk about another character, Carra O'Doherty.
In the situation after the flight of the Earls, they're planning some sort of plantation, 1607. But before that, there's a very dramatic event. So as I said, it's heavily garrisoned. I mean, actually, the English forces are, by modern standards, really very small in size. But there's about 1,000 troops there. And the governors tend to get on very badly with the locals, and in part because they're trying to take their land. So the plantation is bringing in loads of people, but that was the process of trying to take land for the servitors, the military people, is already happening. One of them, and it should be mentioned that the Gaelic lords remaining after the flight of the Earls are the so-called Loyal Irish, the ones who had taken the English side in the Nine Years' War, or more commonly, changed sides during it. So Niall Garve O'Donnell, who was the rival of Rory O'Donnell, the remaining, you know, O'Donnell chief, O'Cahan, who I mentioned before, and Cathair O'Doherty. Now, O'Doherty, who's up in the Inishowen Peninsula, which is considered very desirable and very fertile at the time. We think of it as a very barren place today, but at the time it's very desirable. He gets on very badly with the governor of Derry, who was a man called George Pollitt. And there's various disputes over land and treatment and stuff like that. And Pollitt's troops apparently behave very badly. There's allegations of all sorts of stuff, like including rape. But finally, Pollitt, on a market day, punches O'Doherty in the face in full public. And O'Doherty is not going to let that slide, so he comes back with his forces and takes the infant city of Derry and burns it to the ground. And among other things, he kills Pollitt. Now, the rebellion is not very successful, so the English get in reinforcements. The English and Scottish, because we're now talking about the hybrid kingdom, get in reinforcements. Niall Garve O'Donnell and Donal O'Cahan are arrested and taken to the Tower of London, where they die, although they're not actually involved in the rebellion. O'Doherty is killed, by one account, in battle. In another account, one of his own followers changed sides and shot him in the back, literally, with a pistol. You don't believe which version you will. And his body is displayed, you know, it's mutilated and displayed and so on, on the walls of Derry. But this clears the way for the plantation, because it clears away the most prominent of the so-called Loyal Irish, who would have been an obstacle to plantation. Not all of them, because some of them do get land in the plantation, but the most prominent ones, certainly in the west of Ulster, are cleared away.
So now, as we move on to the plantation, when people hear that six counties are planted, a lot of people assume it's the six counties that now make up Northern Ireland, but it's not. We have Donegal, not Derry, as it's known as Coleraine back then.
County Coleraine, yeah.
County Coleraine.
Yeah, County Londonderry is created a bit later.
Yeah. Tyrone, Fermanagh and Cavan.
Yeah, and not Monaghan, because interestingly, Monaghan had been not planted but divided up among Gaelic freeholders in an earlier scheme in the 1590s, which is one of the sparks for the Nine Years' War. So yeah. Monaghan's not planted either, which is something you wouldn't expect. Although there is, you know, later, there's actually a lot of Protestant and Scottish settlement in Monaghan, but not in the plantation.
So, as we said in previous episodes, Ireland had been shired, turned into counties.
Yeah.
And this county of Coleraine, it's expanded. So they take part of what becomes South County Derry, used to be part of O'Neill's areas in Tyrone, as part of North Antrim is moved in. And what were the plans then for the plantation in terms of the people who would move in and take the land in these six counties?
So it goes through a few drafts, and the first draft is Chichester. And remember, Chichester is the Lord Deputy, which is the Governor of Ireland, but his faction is what's called the servitors, the military people. And Chichester's plan is, you give land to people like me, the military people, and we bring in a certain amount of settlers to show the Irish how it's done, you know, civilised husbandry and so on. But most of the land stays with the Loyal Irish. You know, you just dominate them militarily and you'll eventually assimilate them culturally. Now, Davies, the Attorney General, is not happy with this, and he submits a much more radical plan where the Irish would be removed from the lands altogether in Ulster and they'd be reallocated some of the land, 20% of the land. And you would bring in a vast number of settlers from England and from Scotland to physically replace them. So not just culturally assimilate them, but physically replace them. And this goes through London, it goes through the court of James I. And James decides in favour of Davies' scheme. He's very in favour of it because it has a very big role for the Scots. So remember, James is the king of two separate kingdoms. Kingdom of Scotland and the Kingdom of England. Three separate kingdoms, sorry. Mm-hmm. King of Ireland as well. And he talks about a union when he comes in, but nobody's going to go for it in Scotland. They're not happy about the idea. So it's important to keep the Scottish constituency on side. James also seems to have enjoyed the grandiose nature of the plan, you know, by a big kind of social engineering, totally changing a society. And remember, this is not the only place where they're doing this. Mm-hmm. So the same year as the flight of the Earls, 1607, is when they land in Virginia.
Yes.
You know, the Virginia Company is set up. 1630s, they land in New England.
Yeah.
So, you know, the in some ways, what's going on in Ireland serves as a prototype for what they're doing in North America.
And we have Jamestown in America as well.
Jamestown, correct. Yeah. But the plan is this, essentially. There will be a big class of landowners from England and from Scotland, 120 of them. And they will bring in 24 families on each 1,000 acres. And they're given enormous plots of land. On that, they will have to build defensible settlements. They'll have to build forts and towns and stuff. The settlers will have to be armed. They'll have to be prepared to defend themselves. And they must build churches. The only people they can bring in are settlers who have taken the oath of supremacy. So this means Protestants. So acknowledging the king as the head of the church. And they must not be of the ancient Irish race, as it's called. Now, what this means in context is not only the Gaelic Irish of Ireland, but also the Gaelic Scots as well. Because at the time they're referred to in the English language as the Irish, you know, the Irish country, is how they referred to the Highlands at the time.
Well, we've discussed this before, and I find it interesting that in Ireland, among the Gaelic Irish, when the Stuarts take the crown and James takes the crown of England, this is thought of as a great thing, yeah, that this Gaelic Stuart... but in reality, James had very little affection for either the Irish language or the Gaelic people of Ireland and Scotland.
Yeah, so James had a small amount of Gaelic ancestry because the kings of Scotland had been Gaels in the early medieval period. Mm-hmm. But his ancestors are mostly, you know, Norman, English, if you like. Also, I mean, more importantly, contemporaneously, James, as King of Scotland, has a lot of trouble bringing under control the Gaels of the Highlands and of the West, the Western Isles, particularly if they're Catholics, such as the MacDonald clan, who are in both Scotland and in Ireland. And actually, there's a military expedition and a plantation in the Isles to plant Presbyterians there, Protestants, before even the plantation in Ulster. So the idea is that both the Gaels of Ireland and Scotland share a common culture, which they do, but also they're warlike and they're uncivilized and they must be brought into the civilized fold. They're the enemies of civilization, mm-hmm, if you like. For some reason, though, the Gaels of Ireland, and this appears to be quite a popular sentiment, seem to think that James coming to power is the answer to their problems. You know, that James will be sympathetic in some way, but he absolutely isn't, you know.
And it seems like a similar view of Charles I being a great Gael and as well.
This stuff about the Stuarts lasts for about 2 centuries.
It's incredible.
And it's mostly entirely unmerited. Like,
yeah.
I mean, the later Stuarts are more sympathetic to Catholics and end up being Catholics themselves, but nevertheless, you know.
Nevertheless, not really dependable allies.
No.
If allies at all.
No. Now, okay, that's the Undertakers. Now, the Undertakers are forbidden from taking Irish tenants. The second grantees are the servitors, the military people I've already talked about, such as Chichester. They can take Irish tenants, presumably because they think they can police them better, but they also create these fortified settlements. Then, interestingly, you get the church, the Protestant church in Ireland, the Church of Ireland, and Trinity College Dublin gets a grant of land. Mm. You know, it's fascinating to our eyes, but one of the things that you see when you read accounts is that the churchmen, the Protestant churchmen, are considered among the worst landlords by the native Irish, because among other things, that they're bringing a new religion, they really don't try to proselytize at all, very few of them learn Irish, and they are collecting not only rent, but also tithes, so collecting like a double taxation of the people whose land they're put on. That's basically the plan. Now, as it goes on, it becomes clear this is an extremely expensive endeavour. So the Undertakers are big aristocrats. They have money. They also have a lot of tenants, so they can bring people over. That's the idea. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the capital to build new towns. So Derry has to be rebuilt. And the walls of Derry, as we know it now, are laid out then. Also, Coleraine is a big fortified town. The walls of Coleraine are no longer in existence, whereas Derry's are. But they're the two big fortified towns. And they bring in the City of London, the merchant companies of London, to finance them. This is, from my point of view, fascinating. It's the merchant companies of London are originally guilds, like you have the ironmongers, the haberdashers and so on, but they have capital. They're by now more like, a little bit more like corporations. And they also have access to a lot of skilled labour. So they bring in carpenters and ironmongers and whatever else to build the cities of Derry and Coleraine, walled cities. Mm-hmm. And they're the only ones who can do it. But they're really forced to take a loss to do it by James. On the other hand, they're given things like, they're given monopoly in trade in and out of Derry, monopoly on the fisheries, and they're given the forests of Glenconquin. So Glenconquin is an area of central Tyrone where the O'Neills had, basically it was their fortress, you know, because it was impenetrable. And one of the effects of the plantation of Ulster is the physical transformation of the landscape. So timber is tremendously valuable for shipbuilding, for ironmonging, like you need it for smelting, construction, obviously. And so this is the one bonanza that the City of London gets out of it. They get to rename the city of Derry, of course, Londonderry. But it also, you know, there's Irish poems about the plantation of Ulster. And one of the things that they lament, among other things, is where once we had our hunting grounds, there are now paved streets. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can imagine the physical transformation of the place as well.
Well, this is true. And there's also, you know, apart from the planting the people, there's urbanisation as well. And these plans for building towns all throughout the province.
Yeah. Uniform towns. There's a plan for each one. They're all the same. Yeah. And this is the west of Ulster, but they're laid out in a diamond. There's a central square. There are four streets lead onto it. There's fortifications and so on.
And then for actually carrying out the plantations, these towns have things like courthouses. They have market houses, market squares, jails as well. Very important. But it really lays out, like, you know, that this is a British style of urbanisation throughout Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and this happens elsewhere. It doesn't just happen in Ulster. Like, one of the things that we probably are mistaken in looking back is seeing Ulster as so exceptional. Whereas, you know, that's also true for Bandon in West Cork, a town of 7,000 people, which is very large for the standards of the day, which is walled and which is 100% Protestant at the time, and quite bad, proudly so. You know, the Earl of Cork, Richard Boyle, makes it so. Mm. So, you know, Ulster isn't as exceptional as it appears in hindsight, but this happens all throughout Ireland. It's the idea you must transform the place in your own image, you know.
Mm-hmm. And we should say as well, as part of the, you know, urbanisation, as part of the scheme, there's plans for land to be set aside for royal schools throughout Ulster too.
Yep.
And one of the most famous past pupils would be Oscar Wilde, who went to the royal school in Fermanagh.
Ah, but yeah, we should talk about, I suppose, then the people who come to live there.
Yes. So we have the plan in theory for the plantation. What is the plan in reality?
Well, you know, one interesting thing, I learned this from Jonathan Barden's book, recent book on the plantation of Ulster, which I warmly recommend. In 1608, when the plantation is being planned after O'Doherty's rebellion and the flight of the Earls, of course, the previous year, they do a survey of Ulster for the first time. So it's the first time the English can really get into the interior of Ulster and try to map it. So the Irish hadn't mapped it because that's not the way they rolled, if you like. They calculated landholding by Balia Biatach, food-producing regions. Like, the English had a stereotype that the Irish didn't do tillage. They did, and the English seemed to have thought that the Irish were nomadic, but they weren't. What happened was you just drove the cattle from the hills to the lowlands, depending on the season. So they toured Gaelic Ulster, and interestingly, they conversed in Latin with the natives, which shows you, like, you know, who's the barbarian here, you know? Anyway, they calculated it basically. They gave a barony to each Ballybetach, as they called it. And they grossly underestimated the size of the area they were planting. So the number of settlers they were bringing in was not sufficient to actually populate it. You know, given the fact that the idea was to move all the Irish out by 1615, and we're not exaggerating, that was the plan. But that didn't happen because basically there was far too much land. A lot of settlers actually came and went home again because it was very tough. The reality is the Irish were not removed. They just get the worst land. So the loyal Irish, the Lords, get about 20% of the land, including the O'Neills of the Fuse, which is today South Armagh, the O'Neills of Clan de Boy, and some others. So the O'Neill becomes an aristocratic Protestant name in Ulster, you know, in part. The Irish are not removed. The Undertakers end up taking lots of Irish tenants. They also take quite a lot of Gaelic Scots tenants because, again, the Highlands are poor, people want land, they're available, and in the end, who cares as long as they pay the rent?
Yeah.
So the idea of a, you know, a homogenous Protestant English and Scottish settlement, that just doesn't happen.
English speaking as well.
English speaking. Yeah. Although, I mean, Scots is different enough from English to almost be a different language at this time, but they can understand each other, I presume.
Yeah.
That's one thing. The other thing is, whereas it's supposed to be like the settlement is supposed to be laid out across the province, it doesn't really end up working like that because the settlers take the best land. They end up clustered in various places around the Lagan out Double G, the Lagan Valley, which is in Donegal. not the Lagan in Belfast, but also they end up in clustered around Antrim and Down and Belfast. Belfast is developed by Chichester himself, actually, but it's a very small place still at the time. They end up clustered around there, Coleraine, the Ban Valley, County Cavan, Acker, and North Armagh. So you can see some of the settlement, the sectarian geography, is actually established then, and it's still, to some extent, still similar today. So East Ulster, North Armagh, North Down, North Antrim remains Catholic, actually.
Yeah, funnily enough, that's one of the most bizarre things when you look at a map of Ulster and you look at, like, you know, the demographics. That northeast corner of Antrim always remains Catholic. And strongly Catholic.
Yeah, yeah. And some of whose ancestors would actually have been Scots, you know.
Yeah.
But, the route and stuff. But it is very mountainous territory up there in the Glens of Antrim. So possibly that's why. Like, so the Padraig Lenehan remarks very sarcastically in his book Consolidating Conquest that it has been suggested that the Irish just preferred the hills and the bogs. And he said, but this is not the case, you know. But in terms of numbers, there's a lot of dissatisfaction. Like, James sends over surveyors first in 1612, and they're very unhappy, and there's only about 12,000 settlers there, or they're adult male settlers. But that actually means a lot more, because usually they bring their families. Mm. The English kind of settlement is really clustered in Fermanagh, and one of the interesting things that I learned, again, reading up for this, is that the names of the English brought in at the time, and clustered especially around Enniskillen, are still the most common Protestant names in Fermanagh today. So, you know, like, we're going to talk about the Ulster plantation does not predetermine Irish history, but it really is a marker, you know, it really is something that changes everything in the province of Ulster.
That's interesting as well when you look at, throughout Ulster, concentrations of either Church of Ireland or Presbyterians. And it still kind of corresponds with the areas where either Scots or English went to.
Somewhat, because, I mean, you know, the idea of chain migration, like, the Scots do continue coming, especially to areas which are planted early on, be they in Antrim and Down or be they in the official plantation. Like, there's a big influx of Scots in the 1630s, actually, you know, in hard times in Scotland. There's apparently a famine then. And as we'll get onto in the 1690s, there's a massive influx of Scots into Ulster when Protestants and particularly Presbyterians become the majority in Ulster for the first time at that much later time, 100 years later. But in the period we're talking about, it's relatively slow. Times are tough in Ulster. The natives give very little organised resistance, but there's an awful lot of banditry, what the English call woodkern. And the people who built Derry reported back that they built it with the axe in one hand and the sword in the other. So you had to be on the lookout at all times. The impression you get is kind of surly resentment, but there's very little in the way of organised resistance, because between the Nine Years' War, the flight of the Earls, and O'Doherty's Rebellion, their leaders have basically been decapitated. But there is apparently, which I hadn't known, another attempted rebellion in 1615. So Chichester, the Lord Deputy, reports it. He gets the Parliament prorogued, the Irish Parliament. Partly this is to get a subsidy for the plantation, which is losing money, forced through. Mm-hmm. So, but the leaders, including O'Neill and O'Cahan, are arrested, drawn by a cart through the streets of Derry, and then they are hung, drawn and quartered and displayed on the walls of Derry. So this apparently is quite a serious plot, and there's rumours that O'Neill is on the way back. But O'Neill, Hugh O'Neill, the great O'Neill, as he's known, died in Rome the next year, 1616. So there's initially really not much in the way of organised resistance to the plantation, but all the indications are natives are not terribly happy about it.
Well, unsurprisingly.
Unsurprisingly, yeah. I mean, they you know, the English version is like they're just ungrateful. They don't appreciate the gifts of civilisation that they're being given. But looked at from the other perspective, of course, that doesn't work so well.
And it just endured 9 years of devastation of their province.
Yeah, I mean, one of the English arguments, actually, is that the plantation can happen because Ulster is so depopulated. I'd just like to read out a little bit from a tract that was written by Davis, the Attorney General. And he says, the plantation was justified because those countries are so depopulated as there is not a sufficient number of natives to inhabit and manure third part thereof. And the Irish, besides their fickleness and disloyalty, are at this time so poor and withal so rude and unskilful in husbandry as they are very unfit tenants. For this makes them being altogether unable to build castles or good houses, or to stock and improve the waste lands as that ought. So in other words, you've depopulated the land through fire and sword in the 9 Years' War, and now it's empty, you know. And also, of course, the Irish are too uncivilized to develop a property. They can't build castles, which, of course, they in fact had been doing.
Yes.
So, but it is true that they didn't build towns, and it is true that they didn't have the kind of proto-industry that the English brought in. So, I mean, in fairness, it is true that England particularly, not so much Scotland, were much more developed economically. Even though, you know, in hindsight, we overestimate the extent of this. Like, the population, as I said in the last podcast, of England was between 4 and 6 million at the time. Very small. And the population of Ireland is something between 1 and 2 million. Well, you know, the disparity isn't as great as it becomes.
Yeah, it's not this huge multiples.
In fact, the disparity really only comes after the Industrial Revolution, like after the 1840s, really.
Mm, mm.
So, like, Ireland has roughly half the population of England in the 1840s. But anyway, moving on.
So we should look as well at areas in Ulster where the local population were actually forcibly removed and forcibly depopulated. Places like North Armagh and stuff like that.
Yeah, the thing is, though, like, they're, you know, whereas the idea is this very radical thing where they're completely removed. And Davis, again, who is, you know, even most servitors and English people didn't like him. He's apparently a very fat man and also very petty and vindictive. But in any case, he's clearly an educated man. Davis writes these other tracts saying, you know, transplantations of people are something that happens sometimes. Mm. Look at what the Spanish have done to the Moors in Andalusia, in the south of Spain. And he says, we are much more merciful, actually, than the Spanish, because instead of kicking the Irish out of the country, we're actually rewarding them with new lands. But in any case, it tends to be not quite so radical. So they're not entirely removed. It's just that they're moved to the worst land and they're made tenants of the incomers. They're really not forcibly removed from that many areas. Like, there's areas where the land is all taken by settlers and they're de facto removed. But it ends up being not as dramatic as it was envisaged, actually, I think.
And the other plan as well, of expelling men to join foreign military service.
Yeah, so this is, yeah. So there are a lot of current and former swordsmen, as they call them, soldiers in Gaelic Ulster, left over from the 9 Years' War. And Chichester deports 6,000 of them, which for the time is really rather radical, to Sweden. And Sweden is busy fighting the 30 Years' War, among other things. Actually, in Western Europe, we don't know anything about this, but busy fighting the Russians and the Poles quite a lot of the time as well. Principally the 30 Years' War against the Habsburg monarchy, against the Catholic powers in Central Europe. But of course, a lot of the Irish soldiers change sides, being Catholics themselves, and they go over to the Austrians or the Spanish. And at the same time, independently, there's, you know, Irish Catholic regiments being established in the Spanish army and the French army from the exiles, the wild earls, you know, the earls who have flown.
Yeah.
At the time, but yeah, 6,000 men, and you can probably, I couldn't say this for sure, but probably their family members as well. Like, one of the things that's interesting when you're reading about this is, it's said that equal numbers of settlers were women, and yet, you know, there's very little written, to be honest, about the women, but that must have been very significant in terms of population, because in Spanish America, and this is a comparison that's made, which is obviously so much further away, the distances are so much more, but the settlers are almost exclusively male. So what happens? They intermarry, you know, with the natives. And that doesn't happen so much in Ulster, because they bring over their own wives and their own families. So there is a very, quite a stark degree of segregation in Ulster as well.
I wonder, how long is it before people start to, you know, rub along together and before the later events around the middle of the century, how long does it take before a sort of grudging acceptance of the new dispensation comes about?
It's really hard to know, but I mean, one source that we have from this is from the depositions. The depositions are the statements of the victims of the rebellion of 1641, which is like this cataclysmic rebellion where, among other things, the Gaelic Irish of Ulster attempt to overturn the plantation. So it's throughout Ireland. And there's more to it than that. And religion plays a very large part. And also English politics. But in Ulster, that's basically what it is. And so it all ends in tears. And a lot of Protestant settlers, English and Scots, are killed in Ulster. So not as many as the Cromwellian regime said. You know, not 100,000, whatever. But certainly between 10,000 and 20,000. Between various things. Between actual killing and between hunger and disease after being driven out of their home and so on. But substantial bloodshed, and the depositions obviously are about this. They're actually initially for compensation for victims, Protestant victims, of the 1641 rebellion. Now, that said, people have studied them very closely. People like Nicholas Canny And what they say they show is that there's actually, by that time, by 1641, which is 30-ish years after the plantation, a great deal of familiarity between the natives and newcomers, as someone once called them. That is, people generally knew who their attackers were. They knew them by name. And they named them in the depositions. So I saw Henry O'Neill of this barony come down, and he took my pigs, and he took my cows, and he said he'd come back for me, and he burned the house. So they knew who they are, and they can clearly communicate. Whether it's in English or in Irish or a mixture of the two, you know, it's not clear. Certainly there's some sort of modus vivendi, but on the other hand, what's absolutely clear in 1641 is that grudges had not healed, hadn't even begun to be healed, you know. There's some suggestion in 1641 initially that the English would be attacked and the Scots would be left alone, and of course that doesn't happen. And the great bloodshed of those years, which we covered in a previous podcast, Cahal, you know, it helps to cement, you know, the animosity in Ulster.
Oh yeah, up to the present day. The siege mentality. You know?
I mean, look, a lot of stuff has happened. There's like centuries in between. Yeah. But like, you really can't get away from the fact, and it brought home to me really reading for this episode, the Ulster Plantation is a seminal event. Like, in 1641, the Catholics, which basically means the native Irish at this point, although there's exceptions, I'll talk about some of the exceptions in a minute, are still a majority in Ulster. And it's only subsequent waves of settlement, particularly Scottish settlement, where Ulster becomes majority Protestant. Like, by the early 18th century, the substantial majority, like something like 70% or something, but I don't know, but a very large percentage is Protestant. But in the period we're talking about, it's still majority Catholic.
When we're talking about 1641, there are things that seem surprising when you first read about it, that Sir Phelim O'Neill, one of the leaders of the 1641 rebellion, is an MP. He's a big landowner, and he's Catholic.
Yeah, like in Ireland, you know, widening out from Ulster, 60% of landowners in 1641 are still Catholic. Phelim O'Neill is one of the loyal Irish, you know, and initially the 1641 rebellion starts when Phelim O'Neill goes to the fort at Charlemont, and he knocks on the door and allows to be let in for dinner. So he's, you know, he's a man who gets on with the planters, and he's respected, and he's an MP and so on. So yeah, I mean, the wars of the mid-16th century are where the loyal Irish, if you like, and the old English are wiped out as landowners, not the Ulster Plantation.
Yeah, and this is pre-Cromwell. And that completely changes the whole situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly in the rest of Ireland it does, but I do kind of think, having read a bit more about the Ulster Plantation, that it really is a very decisive event, you know. But just to talk about one or two of the exceptions, which are interesting, there is a man called Audley, who was actually a settler in the Munster Plantation. So first of all, in the 1580s, destroyed in the 1590s, reconstituted afterwards. And he applies to be an undertaker in the Ulster Plantation. And he is exceptionally ambitious. He's the Earl of Castlehaven, which is in Cork. He's exceptionally ambitious, and he presents all these plans to James, where he's going to develop a massive ironmonger industry in the north of Ireland. And it doesn't quite come off, you know. But he builds a lot of stuff also in Ulster. He's accused of some pretty horrendous stuff, including, you know, rape of boys and rape of his wife, which I didn't think would have been a crime back then, but apparently it was. But in any case, his son, the Earl of Castlehaven, is a Catholic, and is one of the Catholic Confederate leaders in the 1640s. So even some of the planters of Ulster were actually Catholic and, you know, fought on the other side in the religious wars of the 1640s. So it's complicated to our eyes. You can't discount the religious element as an independent element. Like, we want, from our perspective, the religion to stand in for something else. The people at the time, no, they meant it. It's about religion. If you change religion, you change sides.
Yes, and wasn't that one of the things that if the native Irish converted to the Church of Ireland, they would be classified as British within the surveys?
That comes about as a result of lobbying. So remember, the undertakers are actually short of tenants. And in 1628, they're granted the right to take Irish tenants formally. And they lobby for, if Irish tenants take the oath of supremacy, then yes, they can be counted as British. But that wasn't the original plan, actually. The original plan is very much rooted in the 16th century conception, where the Gaelic Irish are an uncivilized race and they need to be changed, you know. So the Tudors thinking of it in kind of civilizational terms, and, you know, in the 17th century, it becomes more explicitly religious, I would say.
And this is a thing, really, that this idea that if you have a different religion than your prince or your king, how can you be considered truly loyal? Like, at the very least, you must be suspect.
Yeah, so these are the dilemmas James has as the first Stuart king of England, Scotland and Ireland. you know, he has a Catholic plot at the very start. You know, he Guy Fawkes tries to blow up the Houses of Parliament because they're instituting the first anti-Catholic, well, not the first, but anti-Catholic legislation. In Ireland, he has the majority of landowners are the wrong religion from his point of view. They're Catholics. You know, they can't pledge allegiance to him because they pledge allegiance to the Pope of Rome. And they, what they want at the time is they want to pledge religious allegiance to the Pope and civil allegiance to James. And James says, you can't do that. That would make you half subjects. So, I mean, this they believe at the time in the divine right of kings. It's not easy to separate the two things. Broadening it out from Ireland, like one of the things that happens in Europe is at the end of the 30 Years' War, they pretty much do make some sort of separation because it's necessary. You know, so the power of the prince is one thing and the religion is another thing. Like in most cases, you still have, you know, uniformity imposed. But they have to separate it in the end because it just causes too much problems. It's too difficult to impose conformity everywhere.
Well, particularly in Britain, because you have Presbyterians in Scotland and you have Anglicans in England. Yeah. Very different forms of worship.
And this is ultimately something that causes the Wars of the Three Kingdoms. You know, it's initially caused by the fact that James tries to impose an Anglican, or sorry, Charles I, the son of James I, tries to impose an Anglican prayer book on the Church of Scotland. So, getting away from that, we should probably talk about, you know, the subsequent settlement in Ulster.
Yes, and as you mentioned there earlier, there's a big influx of Scottish settlers in the 1690s.
Yeah, so, you know, the cartoon version of Irish history and the Ulster Plantation is you have the Ulster Plantation and Ulster becomes Protestant, and that's not the case. So, as we said, the initial inflow of settlers is relatively small, but it's thought that there was 40,000 adult males who were British, so it turned they begin to use English and Scottish in Ulster in 1640. Now, if you multiply that by their families, it's considerably larger. It might be up to 100,000, but Padre Glenhan comes into the figure of about 80,000 Protestants in Ulster in 1640. Some of them had arrived quite late. Some of them had arrived in the 1630s from Scotland. And the big influx is actually after the Williamite War, so after the Protestant ascendancy, as we know it, was established. There's also a famine in the lowlands of Scotland. And the people who had come to the plantation of Ulster had generally come from the border region of Scotland. And also, actually, they'd come from the marches between England and Wales and Northumbria. So they were kind of frontier people anyway. But there's a famine in the borderlands of Scotland in the 1690s. And there's a massive influx of Presbyterian lowland Scots to Ulster at that time. Partly to get away from the famine, but also because Protestants could buy land in Ireland. Catholics could not, under the penal laws which are enacted after the Williamite victory in that war, the War of the Two Kings. And so, roughly, you know, as I said, Scots or Presbyterians become the majority in Ulster at that time, and especially the east of Ulster becomes really, you know, not quite exclusively, but nearly exclusively Protestant at that time. The plantation settlements, you know, there's much greater English influence for this reason in the west of Ulster, in places like Fermanagh, but also in Donegal and so on. And it's estimated that 50,000 Scottish families arrived in the 1690s and 1700s. But the interesting thing about this is, shortly after that, the Test Acts are passed, which discriminated also against Presbyterians for the reason we've been talking about, which is that Presbyterians can't recognise the head of the Church of England as their head of the Church. So Presbyterians in Ulster, having in many cases newly arrived in the 1690s, find themselves not quite full subjects either in this new century, the 1700s.
And then we start to see the large-scale migration of Presbyterians from Ireland to America.
Massive. I mean, something like, if I remember right, I think it's something like 200,000 or 300,000 people left Ireland for the Americas in the 1700s. Mm. And of them, two-thirds are what are known as the Scots-Irish.
Yeah.
Which is basically Presbyterians from Ulster.
Yeah. And rather than later Irish emigration to America, going to places like New York and Boston and Chicago, they go to Pennsylvania, down into Virginia, and then down through the southern states.
Yeah, and one thing that's been suggested about this is that these are frontier people. They're frontier people in Scotland, they're frontier people in Ireland, particularly in the 1600s, and they're frontier people in America. They know how to do it.
Yes.
They know how to build compact, defensible settlements to defend farmland. You know, even though your farmland might be spread out, if a settlement you can retreat to defend it. you don't necessarily mix with the natives all that much, and so on. So, you know, the suggestion is that the Scots-Irish helped to build America partly because of what they'd done in Ireland.
Well, that's it. Instead of living on land from dispossessed Native Irish, you're living on land from dispossessed Native Americans.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's a crude stereotype, but, you know, there is some truth in it, you know. And what's fascinating, I always found fascinating, is like in 1998, a long time ago now, I visited Ellis Island with my family. And this is the time of the Good Friday Agreement and all, we're all full of peace and goodwill, you know. But I was fascinated that there was a distinction in their emigration statistics between the Irish and the Scots-Irish.
Yeah.
And I remember being outraged at the sectarianism, you know, of this. But in American society, the Scots-Irish and the Irish were considered something different.
You know, if you look at all the American presidents, the largest single ethnic group are Irish Presbyterians. You know, those Scots-Irish, there's so many of them. There's got Andrew Jackson, the seventh president, his parents were born in Ireland and he ended up in the Carolinas, some of his older siblings. Andrew Johnson.
Ulysses S. Grant.
James Buchanan. Grover Cleveland.
The list goes on, you know.
The list goes on and
far,
on.
Far more than Irish
Catholic. Up to Bill Clinton.
Far more than Irish Catholic, you know. But I mean, it's...
But there's only three American presidents have Irish Catholic ancestry.
Biden,
JFK, and Ronald Reagan.
And Reagan, yeah.
Although he was raised Protestant, his mother was Protestant.
Right. But yeah, I mean, it does show something interesting about American kind of immigration patterns, where you kind of have this fierce ethnic and religious, you know, cleavage for a while, and it tends to eventually fade away. But that's probably the story for another day, I suppose. Yeah. And we should finish up, I suppose, by talking how the Ulster plantation is remembered today, I suppose, in both, you know, Ulster Protestant tradition and also Irish nationalist. And even today, it's possibly been reinterpreted yet again for our times, unfortunately.
Well, as we were mentioning there about 1641, you'd see a lot of the Orange Order banners that they carry at the in their parades will be referencing things like the massacre at the bridge in Portadown, or all these things that are very much in the Protestant psyche about the 1641 rebellion. And you have to, like, I remember there was a speech by Ian Paisley, and this sort of summed up a lot of the thinking that, like, you know, we came to this land, bog land of bog people, and we turned it into the most prosperous part of Ireland.
Yeah, and of course, this is something that's, you know, this is a narrative which develops, but, like, if you look at the development of Ulster, it's quite poor in the 1600s. It's not at all considered, you know, the best province to be in. And in the 18th century, it does develop, in fairness, on the 19th century. You know, so this is part of the Ulster Protestant narrative. Now, as against that, against the Paisleyite narrative of we came here as conquerors and we took it for the Lord and developed it and so on, there is another Ulster Protestant narrative, which is that it's not about the plantation. You know, we came here as settlers. The biggest settlement was in Antrim and Down, which wasn't planted at all. We came from humble beginnings ourselves, and we made something of this place, you know. We are the inheritors of also the Scottish Enlightenment, and we have just as much right to be here as anyone else. So there's a certain amount of pushback, I think, among Ulster Protestants against this idea that they're planters or colonists or settlers as well, you know, that they say we are the natives of this soil, you know, we came here by various means, not just the plantation.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, how many centuries can somebody be resident in the country before they're considered native? And, like, if you've been here for over 400 years, is it correct to keep referring to Northern Protestants as planters and blow-ins?
But clearly it's not. But I mean, just in terms of the way people understand themselves, I mean, I could be wrong about this, and I'm not an expert on the 18th century and the discourse of that time, but what certainly, you know, there's very big buy-in among Ulster Presbyterians into the United Irishmen at that time. And the narrative there is, it doesn't matter from whence you came to Ireland, we're all Irish now, you know, we're going to be citizens and so on. And interestingly, you know, people who were against that, you know, what's known at the time as the ultra-Protestants in the 1790s, they worked quite hard to try to turn the clock back and say, no, we came here as conquerors, and the only way to keep the, you know, the Catholics down, they refer to it in religious terms, the Irish and the Catholics down, is by force, you know. And look, and if you don't, if you let your guard down, they will turn on you. So 1641, equals 1798. They're the same, you know. And Musgrave's famous history of the rebellion. But he works quite hard to say that we are conquerors, and the only way is to keep our guard up at all times. So, but that suggests that a lot of Protestants didn't think that way at the time as well, you know. So, you know, it's a mistake to think that one thing happens, the Ulster plantation, and there's a direct line, you can't change everything. Because all the centuries of people, the millions and millions of people, they all had their own choices to make in between. But in terms of Catholic and nationalist interpretations, you know, the 17th century stuff is, you know, we only have kind of snatches of Irish poetry and so on, but it's very poetic and lost, you know, the idea of like our hunting grounds are now streets, I find that evocative. Another one says, you know, the Gaelic poets and all that, their learned classes have been wiped out, and they say now we have to become carpenters, one of them says, you know. And, you know, the pure religion has been lost and the place is filled with heretics, you know. And to be honest with you, that's what the 17th century poetry kind of says. There's no pluralism there, I must say. In terms of later Irish nationalism, like in the 19th century, where Irish nationalism, as we know it, and the various, you know, the outline of Irish nationalist history that's so familiar, is largely written by Irish Protestants, you know, by the Young Irelanders and so on. And, yeah, I suppose there's kind of a schizophrenia about the plantation. So, obviously, the conquest is bad, the plantation is bad, but on the other hand, you know, we have our great Irish Protestant patriots come from that line, you know. In Irish nationalist discourse, there is also a very ugly kind of strain of, you know, looking back to the plantation and saying, these people have no right to be here. They are settlers. They are planters, you know. And you even find that among figures, you know, like Michael Collins, who says at one point, who goes to Belfast to see the Irish man at home, you know. In other words, Belfast is not an Irish city at all.
Yeah, and you can see that replicated on social media when, like, the ugliest type of discourse, when they're people are insulting each other back and forth, it does turn into planters and go back to Britain. And
yeah, but I mean, there's many, you know, contradictions there. So first of all, not all Ulster Protestants did come as planters. In fact, most of them didn't. Secondly, you know, over the centuries there's lots of intermarriage, you know. Who can say where their ancestry stems from? So the decisive thing in the 1600s and the 1700s was religion. So you could change sides by changing religion. And that's a fact. It's not a fact that there's a clear bloodline, you know, that goes back to the Ulster plantation.
That's not based on your ethnicity.
No, I mean, that's just not possible. You know, as I said, again, thirdly, that makes out that nobody has had any choices in between, you know, whereas they have, you know, what we live in is the world that we make it, you know. But I mean, finally, I suppose we should say, you're seeing the idea of plantations being replicated now as a way of talking about immigration. And, you know, I suppose the first thing it shows is, like, the understanding that the plantation equals the colonisation of Ireland, which I suppose it was. But, you know, the planters are the enemy and that they must be driven out, is the idea. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that people, that's prominent enough in people's psyche that they're able to use it for that.
Well, that's the thing as well. It's a word that's bandied about quite a lot by the far right in Ireland, the new plantation.
Yeah.
And this part of a plantation.
Like, but I mean, I think, you know, you have to be obviously very careful when you talk about immigration and stuff. And interestingly, like, you know, there was a resurgence at the time of the previous refugee crisis in, like, 2015, in the end of the Roman Empire and what used to be known as the barbarian invasions and so on, the movement of peoples. Mm. And you have people like Peter Heather, who's a scholar, who talks about the end of the Roman Empire, and he says what really was brought down by what was known as the barbarian invasions, and he's been accused of racism and so on for that, which I think is ridiculous. Heather, when he's interviewed about this, says, no, you cannot transfer one to the other. You know, the Goths and whatever, who invaded the Roman Empire, came in armed as corporate blocks and took over the state, you know. And he says, that is not what's happening. So, however we want to talk about immigration, and certainly big demographic changes are happening in the world today, it's not an invasion where you come and you take the state and you smash the existing structures and, you know, you take over the country. That's not what's happening. So just to be clear, immigration and plantation, not the same thing.
No, it's a bit ridiculous to make those comparisons, like apples and oranges, really.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose I bring it up just to show the enduring place that the idea of plantation has in the kind of Irish nationalist psyche.
Yeah, but also as well, the fact that a lot of people will misuse Irish history. You have all that thing about, like, you know, the Irish slave narrative as well, that picking different parts of Irish history to make political points in the present. And in a lot of cases, by people with a very poor understanding of Irish history to begin with.
Yeah, 100%. But I mean, I suppose in closing, though, you have to say, and it's kind of, as I said, reading for this episode, has brought home to me. The Ulster Plantation really is a very substantial break, though, you know, in Irish history. It really is something that's very important.
Oh, absolutely. And it's something you mentioned there right at the start of the show, is that before the Ulster Plantation, Ulster is the most thoroughly Gaelic province in Ireland. It's different in a way from the rest of Ireland at that time than Ulster would be different in a way from the rest of Ireland afterwards. It's like the least English speaking. It's the least developed economically. It's the most rural. And afterwards, it becomes different in an entirely different way.
Yeah,
afterwards.
Absolutely. And just to close, I mean, one thing that I always remember is reading Hayes McCoy, who was a military historian of Ireland, and he makes the point that in the 1590s, Hugh O'Neill was defending the interior of Ulster from the English trying to come in from the south. And in the 1640s, the Scots and the English are defending the interior of Ulster from the Irish under Eoghan O'Neill, who are trying to get in from the south. And I suppose that shows you the enduring effect of the Ulster Plantation.
Yes, and on that point, I think we'll wrap it up for this episode. So thank you very much for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at Irish History Pod or on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. And please let us know what you think of this episode and all the other episodes. We really do love to hear feedback from you, the listeners. Please check out our friends at radio.ie for all your radio archiving solutions. And you can find this episode and all previous episodes on irishhistoryshow.ie. Now, we mentioned at the start of the show that John has set up a Patreon for The Irish Story and The Irish History Show. So if you get a chance, we would really, really, really appreciate that if you consider supporting us. And the link is in the show notes. So on behalf of myself, Cathal Brennan, and my co-presenter, John Dorney, thank you very much for listening.
Radio.ie hosts the Irish History Show podcast because history matters. Radio turns 100 years young this year. Radio's history is powered by Radio Archives. For radio archiving solutions from people passionate about radio, visit radio.ie.